This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The place where I grew up was completely shaped by water. In Pittsburgh, the three rivers that come together in the city's downtown and the hundreds of streams, or creeks as we call them, that feed those rivers define the topography and the neighborhoods, even the traffic patterns and culture of Pittsburgh. The place I live now, Winsted, is similarly defined. One half of our downtown was washed away in the flood of 1955, never to be rebuilt. Along Connecticut's shoreline, water shapes the lives of the people who live there even more fully. Your neighborhood might be defined by what cove you live in, and you pay attention to the salt marsh in your backyard because it might just flood during the next high tide. Superstorm Sandy tested Connecticut, but scarier tests are being taken by the people of Texas and California right now. Sometimes not enough water, followed by far too much, can overwhelm our systems. Today we're going to grapple with some of these themes as we listen back to a panel discussion that I hosted last week in cooperation with the International Festival of Arts and Ideas in New Haven. Our panelists for this conversation were Senator Ted Kennedy Jr., who represents Connecticut's 12th Senate District and serves as Senate Chair of the Environment Committee. Also joining us was Leah Lopez-Schmaltz, who's Program Director for the Connecticut Fund for the Environment and its bi-state program, Save the Sound. And Gary Yeo, who's Huffington Foundation Professor of Economics and Environmental Studies at Wesleyan University. Let's listen where we live. Gary Yeo, as we think about the idea of climate change, before we talk about some of the specifics in our state, as someone who talks to a billion Catholics on the planet, the Pope is trying to make a message that climate change and the way it might change our resources, the way it might change our waterways, this is something we have to take seriously, and there's a moral imperative around it. How does this strike you? Is this the time to be having the moral conversation about climate change?
I absolutely think it is the time to have a moral conversation. We've been doing the economic efficiency and the science of and the social science of impacts and how the planet operates and things like that. But we haven't had somebody who has a platform that can reach a billion people just because he's the Pope. But more than that, he reaches many more people than that, in all sorts of faiths, and he's bringing an entirely different metric to the conversation. He is bringing the moral obligation for two things. One is stewardship of the planet, and you don't have to read very far into the Bible to find that humans have been granted dominion over this planet and therefore have an obligation for stewardship. And he finds that to be a serious obligation. And he's also speaking very strongly about the least advantaged, the most vulnerable of us on the planet. It has been long known that the poor will suffer most and are suffering most from the impacts of climate change, and that will only accelerate. And he finds it a moral issue, and I think he's right, that those of us who are more advantaged take seriously our obligations to help those who are less fortunate. If you're poor, if you're old, if you're very young, if you live within a couple of meters from a coastline, you are extraordinarily vulnerable. And if you qualify in more than one of those categories, you are doubly vulnerable. And it's the obligation, even through the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, to take that obligation seriously. That has been on the books since the end of the 1980s. I think when the Pope says that and brings it up as an obligation within the Catholic Church and elevates the discussion to include moral issues, it could potentially be a game changer.
So, Leah, talk about that. One of the things that's so interesting is we've tried to tackle the problem of climate change, say, from a political standpoint, from an economic standpoint, from a scientific standpoint, certainly. We haven't really grappled with it at this deep moral level that we're talking about here. Do you think for you in the work that you do around water resources that this is a game changer in some way, that we actually maybe see another window opening up where we can have a conversation, a new kind of conversation about this stuff?
I do. I think that part of it is he's taking away the arguments about science at this point, right? It's this idea that we are here on this planet and we now have to care for it. And I think that's something that we all feel, especially when we get around water. There's something very primal about it, and the way that we connect to it isn't really explained by science or by economics. It's really just a draw, and that also then helps us steward those water bodies. So I think there's something that's timely about that and matches very well with the way that a lot of people here in Connecticut actually deal with Long Island Sound and our rivers.
How do you see this view of stewardship, Senator, in your role now as a lawmaker? I mean, do you think that your fellow lawmakers are ready to see themselves as stewards of this great resource, Long Island Sound, or any of our natural resources in this time of seismic change?
Well, I think we're lucky to live in a state where environmental stewardship has been a strong ethic for many generations. And I must say that it's been a strong ethic for not just Democrats, but Republicans alike. And as chair of the Environment Committee in the Senate, State Senate, I'm lucky that we have a very strong bipartisan, we work in a very strong bipartisan way, in a consensus way. In many ways, the committee is really self-selected. If you think about it, people who care about these issues want to be on the committee, and we have obviously some of our disagreements in how to pay for some of these pollution control activities and some of the expensive things that we need to do to protect our environment. But by and large, I think people know that Connecticut in Long Island Sound has been called the keystone environmental asset of our state. In fact, the name Connecticut is a Native American word for great tidal river, and named after, of course, the Connecticut River. So we have, when we think historically as well, it is the water power that really made Connecticut an economic power of the Industrial Revolution. It's not a mystery why here in New Haven we have all these old factories along the Housatonic. What drove the Industrial Revolution and why Connecticut was the leading. I mean, obviously, we have our economic challenges now. We're hearing about it in the news every day. But we had a natural resource of tremendous amount of water and water power that factories used to run these plants and employ hundreds of thousands of people. So we're very lucky that we have this incredible resource, and we're lucky that the citizens of this state really value that resource.
I think throughout the course of our program here, we're going to talk a lot about some of the resources, the inland resources as well. But Leah, Gary, maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you think the state is doing to prepare our coastlines for rising sea levels, for the impacts of climate change. What are some things, Leah, you think that we're doing well and the things that we're doing not so well?
I think the state's actually started the conversation about resiliency in a really great way. We are kind of ahead of the curve from the perspective of the rest of the coastal states in the country. And our Department of Energy and Environmental Protection started a joint center with UConn to talk about how is it that we're going to deal with rising sea levels? What are we going to do whenever we have these inundations that are coming with ever-increasing storms? What are the members of the public supposed to do to protect their property? And how do we protect our public access areas while we protect the infrastructure that's so critical to the nation, I mean, to our state? So I think those conversations have definitely begun, and we've started to see some new policies being developed and state funding going to these kinds of investigations and developing pilot projects so that we can test out some of the techniques that we can use. So I think the state's definitely on the right path. There's still obviously a lot to be done, but that center, I think, is one of the best things that the state could have done at this time.
Of course, at this time, Gary, this is the problem we see. You've been studying climate change for decades now, something that you've said is coming, and we're now talking about making investments that probably to truly be resilient or truly adapt we probably should have made years ago. I mean, how are we doing on the investment end of things?
We're doing better than most, but let me add to the answer about how the state is doing. The Nature Conservancy, through a fellow named Adam Wexel, has spent an enormous amount of time over the last 2 or 3 years going from town to town to town with a template that was developed by the New York Panel on Climate Change and the Adaptation Task Force under Mayor Bloomberg to help people organize their thoughts about responding to the risks and thinking about development options. And if you're going to replace the road, where do you put it? What material do you use? If you're thinking about a development, how do you look forward? Which leads me to your question. As you think about about climate change and the way the future is unfolding. It strikes me as essential to recognize that looking backwards is not particularly instructive. The old normal is broken. We have no idea what the new normal is going to be, but we have a wide range of possibilities of how the future is going to unfold. And as you think about investments in infrastructure and personal investments in housing and things like that that are supposed to last for 40, 50, 80 years, some of the investments that were made in Boston and New York are now 150, 170 years old. That's the lifetime within which you have to make some consideration, and you have to think very seriously about what the range of possibilities are for the sources of stress. Another thing, the senator, I'm sure, can talk about the aging infrastructure across the state of Connecticut. It's both a challenge and an opportunity to think about how the future will unfold and think about where I-95 should be, where the railroads should be, what they should look like, how they should be protected, how the wetlands should be protected and allowed to respond instead of being backed up against barriers and dikes and bridges. And bridges, I guess, are not too bad.
But I think you raised something really interesting. Is the big question is, okay, where should I-95 be? Well, right now it's right next to the water, and that doesn't seem like a particularly good idea. But then you start to think about what it would cost to do something different. Then you start to think about the individual homeowners, the question of buffering the coastlines, maybe not having homes built right up to the edge. Now you have billions of dollars of personal property decisions being made. I don't know, Senator, I mean, how do you start biting some of these things off? Because on one end, you're not going to start telling people in Connecticut you can't build right where you have built and your family's lived for 100 years. You're also probably not going to quickly change our transportation infrastructure, whether it's an Amtrak line or an I-95 right next to the Sound. Where do you start?
Well, I think I'm glad you raised those points, John, because as a state legislator, these are when we talk about global warming, which is obviously a global problem, what does it mean for our state and the state of Connecticut in the Connecticut shoreline? And it is manifest in those exact issues that you raised. The question about do we continue to allow homeowners to wall off their property, buttress their property, should taxpayer money be used to pay for those improvements? There are some people who say, you know what, we shouldn't be building homes so close to the water. We should not be encouraging people to rebuild a home that has been washed out. Taxpayers should not be subsidizing, for example, flood insurance or homeowners insurance for those types of purposes. Then you look at, for example, the property values in the district that I represent, which includes Brantford, Guilford, and Madison. And the real estate industry will tell you that the value of these waterfront homes have declined since those big storms that we experienced. And one of the reasons is the homeowner's insurance, the cost of maintaining those homes has skyrocketed. And when those homes get revalued, as we do because we're such a property tax-dependent state, and suddenly those $3 million waterfront homes are now worth $2 million, just for argument's sake, well, how does that town make up the difference in that lost revenue? Well, they start raising the taxes on the other houses that are not adjacent or abutting the shoreline. So everyone else's property taxes go up. So it's a very interesting dynamic, what's happening in insurance, what's happening with property taxes. And I just want to respond finally with this one thought. The town of Guilford has done a great job in developing a flood and storm action plan. What that means is we know when we get a new storm that comes in and FEMA shows up with their checkbook, they show up, the federal government will show up, we're going to have another storm, we know it, we just don't know when it's going to be. They show up with a checkbook, and the projects that are going to get funded are the ones that are shovel ready, the ones where there's been community planning, the ones that we actually have a plan for. Those are the communities that are going to get the millions of dollars. And the other coastal towns, and there are many of them along our shoreline, that have not taken the time to plan for these events are going to get left out because they haven't done the pre-planning that's going to be necessary for the post-storm reconstruction and rehabilitation.
Leah, quickly, and then Gary.
Yeah, and I think one thing around the idea of infrastructure, you know, when we're talking about it, sometimes we think about these hardened kind of infrastructure pieces, but really nature does a really great job of being able to buffer our systems for us if we just take care of it and restore it. So we had some instances around Hurricane Sandy where we had beach dunes that actually protected the Amtrak line right behind it that would have been completely devastated had that dune system been, say, torn down for a new house to be put in. You can do green infrastructure and flooding mitigation by installing swaths that absorb rainfall as it's happening and do that right in your own community. So when we're thinking infrastructure and planning, like you're saying, we also need to be thinking bigger than just the big dig kind of projects. We need to be thinking about these smaller natural systems that will help absorb some of that energy.
Gary?
Yeah, I have three short comments. One is the vulnerability of the coastline of Connecticut isn't just storms like Sandy. Sea level rise makes ordinary nor'easters much more dangerous and much more damaging, and that trend will only continue as sea level rise goes up. And so you're not necessarily simply preparing for the next big storm that comes up and turns left at New York City or Long Island, but the ordinary storms that happen once every other year or once a year or the five-year storm is now looks like what used to be the 50-year storm. Secondly, the insurance premiums definitely do go up, especially if insurance companies are allowed to look forward to make their premium calculations rather than have to look backwards. And it becomes expensive, and that affects property values. But there are places where insurance companies have also worked with homeowners to think about protective adaptations that the homeowners could invest in that would reduce the premiums if they undertake that. And they sign contracts for 5 or 10 years with an insurance company for lower premiums for sometimes pretty dramatic investments, raising a house on stilts. The people who live across the street aren't real happy about that, but your insurance premiums go down from $20,000 on a $1 million house to $4,000 on a $1 million house. If you can come up with that money, 2 years ago, the internal rate of return on that investment was 12%. I challenge you to go find some place 2 years ago where you could have put your money and earned 12%. Those people are not doing it because they think a lot about environmental risk. They're doing it because financially it is valuable.
Gary Yeo is a Huffington Foundation professor of economics and environmental studies at Wesleyan University. And we're listening back to a discussion that we held at Yale's Eisman Theater about our waterways and our changing environment. Our other panelists were Senator Ted Kennedy Jr. and Leah Lopez-Schmaltz of the Connecticut Fund for the Environment and its program Save the Sound. If you'd like to join the conversation on water as a resource and a threat, comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We'll be back right after this on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're listening back to a panel discussion we hosted about water, which was taped last week at the International Festival of Arts and Ideas in New Haven. Our panelists were State Senator Ted Kennedy Jr., Gary Yeo, a professor of economics and environmental studies at Wesleyan, and Leah Lopez-Schmaltz, who directs the Connecticut Fund for the Environment and its bi-state program, Save the Sound.
Leah, Long Island Sound, as we know, is changing in a lot of ways. It's getting warmer. The actual makeup of the water is changing. Give us a thumbnail sketch of the things that concern you the most and the things that you're trying to take action on the changes right now to Long Island Sound.
I think there are probably three big ones. One, everyone's probably been hearing it on the news, the fish die-offs that have been happening, not only in Long Island Sound and along the eastern part of the state, but in Peconic Bay, two massive menhaden die-offs in the last week and a half to 2 weeks. The turtles that died on the north shore of Long Island, again, a die-off all within 1 month's time. And I think that's telling us something. And as scientists have started to try to figure out what is happening, one thing is becoming a little bit more clear is that there there probably is a lot related to nitrogen and the idea of hypoxia or nitrogen pollution in general, which creates these dead zones in the Western Sound, especially as algae kind of eats up the nitrogen and grows really big mats. When it dies, it eats up the oxygen, and anything that's trying to live in that area obviously can't because it needs the oxygen that no longer exists. So this idea of nitrogen pollution, it seems to be kind of an underlying problem, whether it's the turtles dying from eating toxic algae, which was grown on that nitrogen pollution, or it's Manhattan that aren't able to access enough oxygen right now because of low dissolved oxygen. So I'd say nitrogen pollution being one big one. Bacteria is another big one. You know, we've talked about plans for nitrogen, but we haven't really talked about bacteria plans. And I think everybody in this audience probably likes to go to the beach. You know, last summer alone, the state of Connecticut lost 117 beach days because of closed beaches.
And it wasn't always like that. I mean, we take it like this happens all the time, but this is a newer phenomenon.
It is. And when you look at the number of beaches that are impacted and fail water quality tests, basic water quality tests for health, we average at least 10% failure rate. In some areas, like in Clinton, we get a 30% failure rate. So we've got some high levels of bacteria, which not only impact our beaches and, you know, potential swimming health, but also sometimes our oysters and our shellfish. You know, that's one of the reasons why we have to put our shellfish in cleaning areas, so that they can kind of purge some of that bacteria and pollution out of their systems before they go to market. It shouldn't be that way. We should be able to eat our shellfish and not fear about whether or not it might have a little bit of bacteria in it. We should be able to take our kids to the beach and let them go in the water without worrying that we have to hose them down for fear they might be getting waterborne illnesses. And I guess the other third big piece is this idea of what happens when climate change and ocean acidification starts to mix with some of the issues we have in Long Island Sound, like hypoxia. Scientists are just starting to find out that there's this magnifying effect that happens when you get some low pH in the sound with low oxygen levels that is much greater than either one of those issues alone. And we don't really know what that's going to do in the long term. But one thing is for sure, it's not going to help our fish or our oysters. It's only going to harm them. So we need to really start figuring out what we're going to do if we want to have a sustainable oystering industry, if we want to make sure that, you know, our commercial fisheries and our oystermen or shellfishermen are able to actually make a living on the Sound.
And the lobster fishery, Gary, it may be gone forever. I mean, it's essentially the lobster industry of Long Island Sound is something that is changing with the climate, something that's changing with the water temperatures. We're not finding the lobsters here. The lobsters are farther north. Maybe we're going to get other invasive species from the south moving into Long Island Sound.
Exactly right. I was at a meeting yesterday and somebody proposed an objective to reestablish a viable lobster industry in Long Island Sound in the next 5 years and have it last for 25 or 30 years. That's an impossible objective. The lobsters have left and they're not coming back because the water's too warm. They just don't like it. And you can't make them live where they don't like to live. Maine is doing perfectly well, and lobster prices aren't that high, but they're not coming from the Long Island Sound.
Yeah. So as part of all this, Senator, there's a Long Island Sound Blue Plan passed by the legislature this past spring. I know that we've been working at the state level to try to preserve the Sound, to make the Sound a viable fishery, a viable place to take our kids to the beach. What does the Blue Plan do that we haven't done before?
Well, the Blue Plan, as many people may know, we've never done a comprehensive, data-driven, scientific analysis of the resources in Long Island Sound. As amazing as that is, we've never, and all the competing interests of the Sound, we've never really done an inventory, so to speak, of the competing uses, the many different uses of the Sound. And this will, for the first time, it came out of the Environment Committee. It was passed by both the State Senate and House of Representatives. It's going to be signed into law by the governor, creating an approximately 15-person board to basically become a blueprint for the future and help to understand some of these competing uses. There have been many people in this room remember some of the different proposals to, for example, industrialize Long Island Sound by these gigantic energy projects by companies who've come out of state and wanting to appropriate our natural resources for their own profit. But there may be better places to put these types of industrial facilities. And so that will be for the first time. We'll be able to undertake that. There are going to be a series of public meetings and then a report back to the legislature. So this process is going to take a little while. But I'm really encouraged that for the first time we're going to have a much better understanding from a data perspective. I think that so much of what we talk about, particularly in the Environment Committee, people are dealing with very emotional issues. I think it's really important to really make sure that we undertake public policy based on sound scientific-based decision-making process, and that's what we're going to be able to do with the Long Island Sound Blue Plan.
Environmentalists, people in your world, Lee, have been pushing for something like this for a long time. I mean, how does this help? It could, on one hand, sound like another 15-person Blue Ribbon Committee that's a bunch of government folks looking at something they should have looked at a long time ago. Another way to look at this is you folks have been asking for this for a long time. Getting something that actually takes an inventory of the resources of the sound sounds like a pretty good idea.
It's a fantastic idea, and its time has definitely come, and we were very excited that it passed. And I think one of the big points about this plan also is it's not only an inventory, but it's actually a legal trigger in some ways that provides the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection with criteria that they can use when they're evaluating proposals. We could have had, say we had five proposals for Broadwater in Long Island Sound, five different Broadwaters. At the same time, DEEP would have only been able to take each individual Broadwater and compare it to the state regulations and then make a decision on it by itself. So if they all met the regulatory criteria, they all would have been permitted. There was no ability to choose winners and losers. Now with the Blue Plan, this gives them a way of tying it to our coastal policies, tying it to our Clean Water Act policies, and giving DEEP the ability to make decisions when there are competing interests and competing projects so that we get smarter planning. And I think the other good side for industry in this is that it provides a little bit more certainty. Right now, if an industry wants to do something in Long Island Sound, they know that they're going to be fought, right? I mean, they're going to have Save the Sound beaten down their door saying that that is not an appropriate use for Long Island Sound if they want to put a massive industrial complex in the middle of the Sound. This way, they have some idea of knowing what is and isn't okay, because there will be these analysis of resources. There will be kind of an outline of the policies that they have to abide by. So it gives the regulatory world a little bit more certainty. So it's really a win-win for everyone around.
Gary, how can we be so starved for data, though? I mean, how can it be that after all these years centuries of viewing this body of water as the most important natural resource in this part of the world, that we're still looking for data to deal with, to look at?
For a long time, I'm not sure people knew what question to ask and what data to collect. And part of the problem, I think, is less now that you don't have data that you wanted, but you don't have a very long time series to be able to study the implications and get some statistical idea of what the consequences of this or that or something else might be. So institutionalizing that, putting it in one place, putting some people on charge of it who will take responsibility for it, under the Blue Plan is a spectacular idea, and it's, I think the senator is a little bit shy to claim exactly how important this is. This is the first one of these on the East Coast. Connecticut can export this to Massachusetts, New Jersey, places where they will understand the value of organizing data collection and decision making in a way that's systematic and makes some sense, and I congratulate them for it.
In part, is it due to the long industrial history that we have here? You talk about Connecticut being built by the plants that were on these rivers. I mean, another way to look at the rivers for hundreds of years since the Industrial Revolution and the Sound is that's a good place to dump stuff. That's a good place to get rid of things we don't need. And to a certain extent, we've certainly come a long way, but that is still our legacy, right? I mean, we're still dealing with, on all of these rivers, the environmental impacts of that legacy. You mentioned the Housatonic River that runs through my part of the world. I mean, GE put a whole bunch of stuff in the Housatonic River that they're not able to get out yet. And so is that part of it? I mean, we're just dealing with a legacy here.
Well, we are dealing with a legacy, and we do unfortunately do have many contaminated sites, groundwater sites. You know, we're talking about obviously Long Island Sound, but about 30% of our state, we get our drinking water through our well water. This is not as monitored as a lot of our other freshwater public drinking water supplies. We have a very high water table in many parts of this state, so people are exposed to a lot of these contaminants. In my district, the town of Durham, in my district is the site of both a state and a federal Superfund site, and most of the town right now is on well water. So people are drinking contaminated water. But I think that just going back for a second to the Long Island Sound Blue Plan, and what Leah said is that I think we need to be smart about how we spend our very scarce resources that we have. We're all mindful in this room that we have to do more with limited amount of money that we have. So when we think about cleaning up our environment, we also need to know what are the areas that are really the most critical ecologically, that have the most abundant, most important ecologically. Removing phosphorus from water or nitrogen from water that is put into an existing water body costs different amounts depending on where you are in the state, and which is why we have a nitrogen credit exchange program in our state that enables municipalities to trade these credits, which is a smart, it's really injecting principle, market-based principles into environmental protection. And it's also being smart because we want to make sure that if we're going to spend valuable dollars to clean up a place like Long Island Sound or our rivers, let's make sure that we're getting the biggest bang for our buck. And I think that's another reason why we need to make sure that we get this accurate.
Since we moved to some of this, Leah, maybe you want to talk a little bit about clean water infrastructure, because I know there are a lot of things on your plate right now. How we actually invest in a sustainable clean water infrastructure, given all of the challenges that we've talked about so far. I mean, what are the things you think that we need to move forward on?
I think one of the things is understanding the economic value of Long Island Sound, which we've kind of started to touch on, but the numbers are huge. It's got a value of between $17 and $36 billion annually to this region. So it's a massive asset. So protecting it is key. And like the senator was saying, investing in the clean water infrastructure that protects that body of water and our rivers is really critical. And I have to say that the state has done a phenomenal job in recent years of investing. Back in 2009, we were looking at permits from DEEP that they were thinking about just loosening the pollution limits in the permit instead of forcing the municipalities to do upgrades because there was no money. The municipalities couldn't afford to do upgrades. So there was a coalition of people who came together that included unions, it included engineers, it included environmentalists and municipalities, wide-ranging folks that you never find in the room together. All came together to say, this is one thing we all agree on, and we think we need to be investing. And since that, back in 2008, $2.5 billion has gone into our infrastructure for water protection. All of our sewage treatment plants have been undergoing systematic upgrades for nitrogen and are about to start doing the same in the phosphorus realm. And that's made a difference for Long Island Sound. When we're talking about that dead zone in the Western Sound that's persistent, we've actually had some of the better years in hypoxia. We've maintained and kept our hypoxia in the same level as it's been for a little while, which doesn't sound like a huge success, but if you look worldwide, hypoxia is a massive problem that's getting worse everywhere else. Long Island Sound is at least holding its own. So if we keep making those kinds of investments, we'll start to see that nitrogen pollution reducing. So we've made those investments, which has been great, and we've also started to see kind of innovation with green infrastructure. So again, going back to those bioswales, or in New Haven, a lot of people probably know URI's tree program that they've been doing tree pits that filter the water, stormwater, so that it doesn't run off into Long Island Sound or go into the combined sewer overflow and have the raw sewage that sometimes we get being discharged directly into the Sound. Those kinds of projects also clean our water. So it's not only about the hard infrastructure and doing the right kind of investments. It's about helping citizens understand what they can do to help make a difference, too.
So Senator, before we move on from this, do you think we can get to a kind of a holistic policymaking structure here in the state where, I mean, it's obviously, we've said, it's great that we're looking more closely at Long Island Sound and taking an inventory of its resources and getting data around it. But if we don't tie Long Island Sound into all of these other things, our transportation infrastructure, how we deal with stormwater runoff in our town that's 40 miles away from the Sound, we're not going to get our arms around it. Do you see hope for a more holistic policy around some of this stuff?
Well, regarding transportation, I mean, I think everyone in the state knows that transportation is key to the future economic success of our state. We experience bad, you know, difficult transportation problems here, but in Fairfield County, believe me, the traffic, the train, the congestion problems are even worse. So I do believe, look, I'm always, as a state legislator, I'm always looking to find ways to work collaboratively with my colleagues. I think we need it, the future environmental, whether it's environmental policy or transportation policy, I think we need to join together and build a consensus approach, which is similar to what happened with this development of the Long Island Sound Blue Plan.
Senator Ted Kennedy Jr. is Senate Chair of the Environment Committee. We're listening back to a conversation about waterways and our changing environment. It was done in conjunction with the International Festival of Arts and Ideas in New Haven. Our other panelists were Gary Yeo, who's the Huffington Foundation Professor of Economics and Environmental Studies at Wesleyan University, and Leah Lopez-Schmaltz, who's Program Director for the Connecticut Fund for the Environment and its program Save the Sound. If you'd like to join our conversation about water as a resource, go to wnpr.org/where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Neanderthals have long been recognized as humans' closest relatives. So why is it that one thrived while the other died over 40,000 years ago? It turns out that wolf dogs may have actually played a role. Also, Patrick Scahill will stop by to explore the musical preferences of cats. Hope you can join us for a Science Friday edition of Where We Live. Today, we're listening back to a panel that we taped last week at the International Festival of Arts and Ideas in New Haven. Joining me to talk about water and waterways were Senator Ted Kennedy Jr., Leah Lopez-Schmaltz of the Connecticut Fund for the Environment, and also Gary Yeo of Wesleyan University.
I want to move outside of Connecticut just for a moment and ask Gary about what we see in California and Texas right now. California, a historic drought. Texas, a historic drought, followed by this period of rain that clearly the systems cannot handle. Many cities underwater, even again this week. What can we learn from them and what is happening there?
Well, we can learn from those experiences and experiences across the world that these extreme weather events are going to become more extreme and more frequent. The scientific community has to be very careful on what it attributes to climate change and where it has to draw the line and say we just don't know enough. So, for example, it is not difficult to attribute the Texas drought, Texas-Oklahoma drought of the last 6 years to climate change because of an understanding of the process of creating a drought, keeping track of both temperature and precipitation, and the idea that it's pretty flat. So the statistics aren't terribly difficult. It also helped that for 2 years in a row, the point of temperature in Texas and precipitation was 1.5 standard deviations above or below, depending on which one you were talking about, anything in the recorded history. So it was way out of the charts. So the question is, could that episode have been generated by the former climate? No. You can't do that in California, oddly enough. It makes an enormous amount of sense that this enormous drought in California is caused by climate change and warming weather and things like that, but it's a different topography. There's not as nearly as long of a time series in the statistics, and it's a much bigger place. And so you cannot attribute at the moment what's going on in California with respect to drought to climate change, although droughts like that are a signature of climate change. what you can figure out is that these things are going to happen more frequently all over the world and all over the country and all over the United States, and you have to learn how to try to respond well before California did, because they're almost out of water.
So they're almost to that
sort of scarcity.
They're almost out of water, and we that is not something that we face here. As you look forward and you model a world and what it might look like 30, 40 years from now, should we ever worry here in New England that we will become California in some way close at least to that?
I'm not sure we'll get close to that because that's a really extreme drought. But we do have droughts, and there have been times in Middletown where I live that the reservoirs have gotten down to levels that are dangerously small. But an inch of rain in Connecticut creates 90 days of potable water across the state. So it's a pretty good collection. The vegetation collects the water pretty well. We don't rely on snowpack melting and things like that.
But even given that, and even given that resource, are we too free and easy with this as a resource? I mean...
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely
we are. I mean, we don't take into account the variability, and the variability is going to get worse, and the periods of... too little rain and too little water will become more frequent. I'm personally much more concerned about the episodes where there's too much water. We have a history over the last 3 or 4 years of some really very extreme, very short duration precipitation events. Sometimes they happen in the winter and it comes down white. Sometimes they happen in the summer and it comes down very, very wet.
And we'll continue to have those events. And as we see in Texas, they will have those events as mm-hmm. well in a very, very different system. I guess part of my question, though, to you, Leah, is us managing this resource. I mean, we still see water as something it's cheap. It's abundant. We don't pay very much for it. I mean, should we be paying more for this precious resource? I mean, a lot of the rest of the world looks at the fact that we take potable water and we spray it on our Camaro as like, what the hell are you doing? Nobody does that, but we do that here in America. I mean, do we have the wrong attitude?
Well, I guess the simple answer is yes, right? I mean, one of the things that Connecticut is grappling with right now is a state water plan, and that came from kind of a discussion of whether or not UConn was going to be moving water from one part of the state to another to take care of this growth. And Connecticut recognized that that means we really need to start thinking about our future, not only about, you know, the water that we drink, but also all of our water resources, what we discharge, how we discharge it. Is there a way of reusing it so that we're not just completely discarding water that can be used for other purposes? So yes, I think we have to get smarter about the way that we use water, and also understand that we require systems as part of our daily life that we need to pay for, things like stormwater management. You know, it's not a sexy topic. Nobody wants to think about those little pipes that are under the ground taking stormwater from one place to another. But the truth is, the stormwater that's coming off of your home, off your roof, and off of your pavement does need to go somewhere, and the state needs to manage it, or the municipality needs to manage it, and it needs to be, at some point, hopefully, managed for pollution sources. And that's a cost that we need to figure out how to pay for.
And those pipes under our streets here in Connecticut are old, Senator. They're very, very old. This is an infrastructure. I mean, we're billions of dollars behind where we need to be in rebuilding this infrastructure.
We are. We are we live in an older city here in New Haven. It's interesting how a development and water delivery, potable water delivery, has been a political issue with many towns actually not wanting to develop their infrastructure and water lines and water pipes. Because once you lay a water pipe, once you build a sewage system, guess what happens? You get sprawl. And there's a reason why, if you look at in my district, Brantford, we have sewage treatment plants and water lines. In Guilford, Madison, other parts, they have no wastewater treatment plant. That restricts towns' ability for economic development. And there people are, well, we need more development. We need office. No, can't have an office building because an office building can't support those kinds of infrastructure demands. Water is relatively cheap in Connecticut. We pay between a half a cent and a penny a gallon for fresh water. It costs us about $90 every 3 months, so about $30 a month, about a dollar a day, if you really think about it, per household for the water. And the average is about 125 gallons per person per day. So we do consume a lot of fresh water, but about half of that water we pay for as usage fee, and the other half, if you're in the regional water company, now we have municipal water companies in our state that are owned by the towns. We have privately held and publicly traded water companies. There are many water companies where you can go out. Right now, Connecticut Water, you can buy their stock. Call your broker tomorrow and buy stock in water companies here in Connecticut. And the Regional Water Authority and the Water Authority in Hartford were legislative, quasi-public agencies that were created. The issue is, as many of us know, the issue of electricity, been following that issue, and in terms of how much of our bills are fixed costs versus usage, right? And obviously we want to encourage people to conserve. And that's a big debate. Well, the same thing is true if you get your bill from the regional water company here in the greater New Haven area. About half of your bill is just fixed. Stays the same whether you use 1 gallon or 1,000 gallons, okay? So obviously, as you can tell here, the way I think about these resources is, are we paying for this resource in the right way? Should we? A lot of these water companies have invested millions and millions of dollars in infrastructure, and they claim, well, we can't have too much conservation. We have too much conservation, and guess what? Your water bill is going to go down, and then we miss our projections about our ability to repay the millions of dollars it takes to, you know, lay the pipe and develop the sewage treatment plants, right? But I think we're lucky here in Connecticut where our water is cheap. And many industries are out there. For example, the semiconductor industry is an industry that requires a tremendous amount of water. And I think it's an interesting question. I don't know what the answer is. But maybe we should be thinking about, you know, using this resource and our competitive advantage, so to speak, and how, you know, wet it can get in our state, to maybe be going out there and trying to attract businesses.
I would like the other panelists to maybe react to that last point. Leah, I'm looking at you.
And I'm looking at Gary.
what do you think of the senator's idea? I mean, use our water resource as a competitive advantage here. Bring some business in. It's expensive to do other businesses here, but maybe a water-based business is really cheap.
I think it's an interesting question, too, and maybe one of those that could be part of the water planning process discussion or a task force to kind of take a look at what kind of industry might be able to be, might benefit from some of our resources here. But without knowing too much about
that. Leah doesn't want people coming into our state to pollute that great water that we have.
Thank you, Senator.
Gary Yeo, Mr. Economist, what do you think?
Sure. I don't have a lot to say except that I've learned from my water expert friends that there's a difference between using water and consuming water. And as we think about bringing businesses in, we might want to think about businesses that use water, but it gets back into the system in a way that other people can use it, as opposed to consuming it, which means that it ends up sort of disappearing from the system and can't be used further.
That's Gary Yeo, Huffington Foundation Professor of Economics and Environmental Studies at Wesleyan University, Leah Lopez-Schmaltz, Program Director for the Connecticut Fund for the Environment and its bi-state program Save the Sound, and Senator Ted Kennedy Jr., Senate Chair of the Environment Committee. Thanks to the International Festival of Arts and Ideas in New Haven for hosting our conversation. Special thanks to Alex Ripp. Our program is produced by Lydia Brown, Betsy Kaplan, and Tucker Ives. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Talarski. Our interns are Katie McAuliffe, Deborah Timms, and Jules Lefebvre. You can continue this conversation on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. I'm John Dankowski. Thanks for joining us.